This is The End User, episode 149 for Tuesday, October 8th. Skynet rises. Hello and welcome to The End User, the show where we get together and talk about our experience with consumer technology with a bit of news from your perspective. The End User.
It's the tech news that you can use.
I am your host and producer, Chris Barnes.
And I'm Futurist Prime, Taylor Moore.
So, Taylor, we had a bit of a slow week this week, but we've got enough to do a show here.
Well, I think it was very exciting. Our top news this week is what happened to Silk Road, the online so-called gray marketplace, although really it was just a straight-up black market for the most part, was shut down, and the anonymous administrator, Dread Pirate Roberts, was unmasked and arrested.
Right. So isn't that interesting? I remember talking about this when this thing first opened, but they were a site that was on the Tor network that you could access, and they used the Tor network to gain anonymity, and they were heavy into encryption and anonymity. And one of the things that comes along with anonymity is the ability for bad guys to abuse it. And it's also got some good aspects to it, right? I mean, not everything on Silk Road was drugs or, you know, weapons or, you know, whatever you think of when you think of bad stuff that can be sold anonymously. But largely, its kind of ID was the online sale of drugs anonymously. That's kind of how I associated it, at least.
Well, what differentiated Silk Road from other online black markets was their dedication to cryptographic security. So right. They had the best cryptography out there in just about any internet application outside of the NSA themselves, and they were very much dedicated to that. Now, what's incredible to me is that it wasn't the cryptography that was broken by law enforcement. That remains secure in most instances. Now, Silk Road also functions as a Bitcoin bank for its users, and so a small fraction of the Bitcoin stored within Silk Road were also confiscated and seized by the U.S. government. But most of those remain secure, or at least the owners of the Bitcoins remain anonymous and protected through cryptography. But the way that the government was able to connect Silk Road to Dread Pirate Roberts, what happened was 4 years ago when he was setting up the Silk Road infrastructure on his computer, he posted to Stack Exchange to try to find a better way to securely connect to his servers. And he posted it. He posted this perfectly legal question under his real name. It stayed up there for less than an hour 4 years ago, and then he changed his name to something that couldn't be traced back to him. And the U.S. government has been able to make a case in his indictment that they were able to connect this one post by him that he then changed into an anonymous posting and connect it to his modern day activity on the Silk Road. That's just really crazy to me that they were able to go back that far and find something that was barely even a blip in the broader internet marketplace and had nothing to do with illegal activity, and they were able to connect that to him.
So the FBI has seized 26,000 bitcoins. Presumably seizing the servers of Silk Road, and there's some debate, at least, as to, you know, what this is. New territory. They've never confiscated bitcoins like this before, at least to my knowledge. So I'm not sure what they're going to do with those things. You know, if it were a real currency, things would be a little bit different, I'd have to imagine. And perhaps even more interesting, the administrator of the site also had a Bitcoin wallet with 600,000 Bitcoins in them, and the FBI has yet to be successful to break the encryption behind them. So it's sitting behind a private key, which presumably the administrator knows, and they're not able to crack into it.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And it goes to advertise the inherent security of Bitcoins, and also of the Silk Road software.
Yeah, so I mean, what's to stop another site, presuming, just taking the position for a minute, that we think Silk Road is entirely bad, and what's to stop another Silk Road from popping up? I don't think that there really is much.
Well, I've read a few opinion pieces that suggest that the federal law enforcement officials now have inroads into the Tor network that they didn't have previously, and that may give them more insights into how to break down further cryptographically secure marketplaces. But Silk Road is by no means the only active Tor online marketplace out there.
Yeah, true.
And so they already exist. They are already trying to be as secure as Silk Road was. And they will probably come to a point, and if they get shut down, someone else will do it.
Yeah, that's probably true. And I bet you, being in the media like they were, like I said, I remember talking about them when they first opened up shop with the advent of Bitcoin. But they basically have a target on their head. I'm sure they were being watched very, very closely by law enforcement officials. So I think the interesting part to me is just that this is possible. You wouldn't think that you could host a website in this manner and not get taken down. The technology is astounding here.
Well, I just finished reading Neal Stephenson's Cryptonomicon, which predicted all of this in the late 90s.
Yeah, absolutely. That is a prescient book. Absolutely.
It really is. It's shockingly prescient. If you want to get some insight into the cryptography that allows this sort of thing to happen, and also all of the logistics that go into creating a secure online currency, and also it's a very fun read.
Yeah, I haven't read that yet. I'll have to get into that. Well, so anyway, I guess it's pretty much over for Silk Road at this point. They've had their assets seized, and we'll have to see what the government is going to do with what they have seized, and we'll see what happens. I'm sure there will be a long and drawn-out legal battle, which will be entirely boring.
Yeah, probably. We may learn some other gems that are interesting to people who are following the story, but for the most part, once it gets to this point, things will be very slow and possibly boring.
So on the opposite side of the spectrum, we've got Twitter has filed for an IPO, and they lost $79 million in 2012, so I'm not sure I'm not sure how the investors feel about that, but apparently they've got a pretty positive evaluation here.
Well, Twitter is by no means the first company to try to take itself public while still losing a lot of money. And really, as far as buzzworthy tech IPOs go, that is barely even a loss.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm not a financial guy, so it's all kind of gobbledygook to me.
Well, remember 10 years ago, Amazon was trying to go public, or had already gone public, and was still losing money every year.
They were, in fact, weren't they one of the first, you know, really gigantic public.com sites that actually did go public?
No, they certainly weren't the first. They were probably one of the second wave of the dot-com companies. But they were by far and away when they, during their infancy as a public company, they were losing much more money than anyone thought could possibly be sustainable.
Yeah, so I guess you have to play the long game. And that's part of the problem. I'm not sure what Twitter's long game is. I mean, they are making a staggering amount of money. Their revenue in 2012 was $316.9 million. So
that's not a staggering amount of money.
Well, no, but I mean, in context for what Twitter is and where it came from recently, you know, that's a pretty decent amount of money.
Well, as part of their IPO, they've outlined a three-point revenue plan in order to make money, and the vast majority of their money is going to come from advertising from corporate sponsorships. So they are looking for TV networks and car companies and any other large corporation to use Twitter as a means to make product-related hashtags increase their brand presence or go viral or whatever it is that they're hoping to do. But you see it all the time now on just about every TV commercial. Yep. There's a hashtag. Even on some TV shows, they have a hashtag running at the bottom of the screen the whole time.
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
Twitter is planning on using those partnerships to increase their brand presence and eventually make money.
It's still just, you know, again, I'm not a financial person, so I have a hard time seeing the long-term side of things. But just, it seems like they've got this massively popular platform, and they just don't quite know how to monetize it yet, even still. So I'm sure that'll change over time, and they've got their business plan, and we'll see what happens.
We will, yeah. And again, this will be also something that will be... a long, slow, and boring process
until
the actual initial public offering. And hopefully that won't be as disastrous as Facebook's IPO more than a year ago.
So, Taylor, how is the iPhone 5S going for folks?
Apparently, there is a widespread problem in their compass and accelerometer. So this is manifesting itself primarily in the Compass app, which now has a level feature in it. But many iPhone 5Ss, and this is, does not affect the iPhone 5 or the iPhone 5C or any previous iPhones, but just the iPhone 5S in particular is not measuring levels accurately, and it's also not measuring compass bearings accurately.
Interesting. So it's like a few degrees off from being level. That's kind of strange.
Yeah, a few degrees, no more than a few degrees in level, but the compasses in some cases are way off and consistent. So
we can speculate a little bit here. Is this a software or hardware problem is likely the culprit here?
Well, Apple kept touting the capabilities of their new M7 chip, right? It was supposed to aggregate all of the location and movement sensing features of the phone. So it's really hard to say at this point. No one has come up with a definitive answer as to whether this is hardware or software.
Yeah, so I guess we just don't quite know yet, and I'm Hopefully it's software, because if this is a hardware problem, then that is really damning. They're going to have to do some kind of recall or something like that, or have some kind of program where...
Yeah, I don't know what's going to happen.
Yeah, so hopefully it is not that. But yeah, they'd have to eat a lot of revenue from that, like the Xbox program. Remember the trade-in for the Red Ring of Death program?
Oh, yeah.
But we're not there yet. We don't know that this indeed is a hardware problem. But yeah, that's unsettling.
It is a little unsettling. But more people have been affected by an iMessage problem, because this is not a problem that is specific to the 5S. In fact, it happened on my iPhone 5 as well as my iPad. So Apple is claiming it's around 1% of iOS 7 users whose iMessage is not functioning correctly. In my case, I was able to receive messages but not send them. Now, the good news here is that the fix is really pretty simple. They're claiming that a permanent fix will come through in the next minor update to iOS 7. So we're on 7.0.2 now, and we're expecting 7.0.3 in a week or two. But I was able to fix the problem on both my iPhone 5 and my iPad 4 just by resetting the network settings on the iPad. And all I had to do was power cycle my iPhone 5. And so far, that seems to have worked without a hitch. I did not have any problems with it on messages on my computer.
Cool. Well, that's good to know that that at least worked. So if you...
Yeah, but it was very frustrating. Before I was able to, I mean, it was a last ditch effort to reset my network settings. I really didn't want to lose all my Wi-Fi passwords, but that's just something you have to do every once in a while.
Yeah, yeah. So this has been kind of a rough launch for them for iOS 7. I mean, they always have little fixes, but I feel like these are of a magnitude that are greater than their past launches.
I completely agree, and it's a magnitude that is to be expected with a design and rebranding of this effort. I mean, this was a huge overhaul to iOS. And so it's very disappointing that these items have been popping up. But, I mean, the really concerning thing is something like this accelerometer problem in the iPhone 5S, which appears to be very widespread.
All right. Well, shall we turn on the afterburners? We'll get moving a little more quickly if you want to snap your seatbelt together.
Sure. Seatbelts in. Let's go.
All right. So CBS has announced that they are releasing an iOS app, an Android app, and a Windows 8 app. They previously had an iOS app already, and you're going to be able to watch the five most recent episodes 8 days after they have aired using these applications. So it's not something they were doing previously. You can watch in this new application, you can watch the entire episode.
There have been some notable absences from these apps, especially in the iOS app, which I downloaded when they launched in March. And their two most popular shows were not available. And I think the Big Bang Theory is still... Big Bang Theory is available, but How I Met Your Mother is not available on the app, and neither is Under the Dome, which is the only... the only CBS show that I tried to watch this past year.
That's a bunch of pretty glaring holes. So I guess they're saying the rule of thumb is that they're going to offer that kind of service, but it's not guaranteed for any individual show. Thus, further confusing consumers. But you are going to at least get some more content, even if it's not the top-tier shows.
They are still really dragging their heels on taking their network online. And it's starting to look really ridiculous. I guess they really want to hold on to their moniker of the most watched network on television. And once people start watching it online, they will no longer be the most watched network.
Although maybe another network can overtake them with a brand new reality show.
Yeah, that's right. NBC has just announced their plans to launch a reality game show in which contestants will be competing to go to space on board Virgin Galactic's Spaceship 2. So this is a prize worth several hundred thousand dollars, and it won't come to the air presumably until sometime next year, because we won't even see any launches by Virgin Galactic until 2014. This is probably the first reality game show that I have been interested in watching or indeed competing on, because I would really love to go to space for free.
Yeah, wouldn't that be fun? Actually, it probably wouldn't be fun, but it would be it would definitely be a cool thing. So Dell has released some details about a couple of Android tablets and as well as some Windows tablets. And they're most notably not going with any Windows RT devices. So they are not going to use the ARM version of Windows. They've got some Haswell-powered devices. And they've got their so-branded Venue 7 and Venue 8. And their Venue 8 Pro and Venue 11 Pro devices.
So right, so...
These will range from $150 up to $500 for the Venue 11 Pro there. So we'll see if they can break into the market. The Android tablet market is a busy one.
That is right, but Dell has a lot of market power, and it's a cheap option for a tablet.
Yeah, those are really decent-looking prices, aren't they?
Yep. So for the Windows tablets... they're a little bit more expensive, but it's full Windows for as little as $400. It's not that bad.
Yeah, it's more of a kind of laptop shoved into a tablet than anything else.
Yeah, that's right.
So Google is going to be launching a new view of Chrome into Windows 8. You know, currently they have this Metro mode where you can launch Chrome just as it were inside of a... Metro-style application. And I've played around with it, but I haven't really used it a lot. But apparently they're going to start bringing a lot more of the Chrome OS features into that view so that you can kind of get this slice of Chrome OS inside of Windows.
Yeah, that sounds really cool. I'm sort of looking forward to that. It would be nice to have the features of Chrome OS available inside a full-fledged operating system like Windows.
Yeah, so the idea is that they're going to kind of mimic the way that Windows 8 apps work. So it'll be interesting to see what they do with this.
Well, speaking of Google adding features, they have put Hulu Plus capability onto the Chromecast TV dongle. So that is really great if you are paying $8 a month for Hulu Plus, but don't feel like shelling out a full $50 for a Roku. I'm kidding, of course. I'm actually this makes a Chromecast a very serious option for me since my TV situation is changing.
Yeah, the Chromecast, we're going to see this happen over time. It's going to happen slowly, but they're going to keep adding more apps, and eventually I think they're going to open up the store to non-partner developers. And I'm looking forward to see how this matures, because it's still very young, and it'll be interesting to see what kind of applications end up here. And Hulu is an absolute must-have, so it's good to see that.
Yeah, I agree.
So Microsoft has released an update to their Windows Phone YouTube app, for Windows Phone 8, that is. And again, we've talked about this before. In fact, I've gone on a pretty long rant on the podcast before, but Google is continuing its anti-competitive behavior by not allowing Microsoft to build a real YouTube app. And so Microsoft released an update so that the YouTube app would launch a... So the YouTube app would launch just like a web view. So it's just the mobile YouTube website. And I guess it's better than nothing. And the app that Google broke didn't work at all anymore. So the just having a link to the mobile website is better than absolutely nothing. But I really hope that Microsoft and Google can figure this out, because this is not good for consumers of YouTube and consumers of Windows Phone devices. So hopefully they can bury the hatchet.
Especially since it sounds like Microsoft worked pretty hard to make a decent first-party app, and the fact that Google broke it is something that they should be able to get past.
Yeah, Microsoft kind of poked the bear at first, and then they released a more serious one, and I guess Google was still kind of burnt by it. So, I don't know. I just want an app, and I'm a consumer of Google services, and not having an app on Windows Phone is hurting me.
Sorry, Chris. Well, in this week's The End User Public Service Announcement, we wanted to turn your attention to Evernote. It now has two-factor authentication. So if you use Evernote, enable two-factor authentication.
Cool. So that's always good to see. Anytime a service turns on its new two-factor, that's always good to see. Especially, some people just live in Evernote. So if your life is stored away in Evernote, you better keep it secure.
Yeah, I've noticed more and more people, but that is the end of our afterburners, so let's turn them off and unbuckle our seatbelts.
All right, well, we can get into the curve of the end user stories. What do we have coming up here with LG?
All right, so last week, LG had a press release saying they are launching full-scale production of their curved OLED smartphone displays. So what that means is we can expect... more and cheaper curved displays on smartphones. And this goes along with a prototype display that Samsung showed off this past summer. But before you go thinking you're going to get foldable, rollable displays on your smartphone and be able to just like crumple it up and throw it in your pocket, I want to disabuse you of that notion through an article that Ars Technica wrote, pointing out that this is a great advancement in smartphone technology, but it's a small incremental advancement. We are not going to get displays that can be folded, rolled up, or anything like that. The radius of the display curvature is limited by the electronics that they apply to it. And they apply it on a substrate in a vacuum chamber, and so they're still pretty delicate. The only difference is they are applying this to a flexible polymer substrate as opposed to glass. So it's good news that we have less glass in our smartphone displays in the future, but we are nowhere near being able to do anything crazy or cool with these.
Yeah, so no morning pants. No morning newspaper or magazine style replacement screens. You're not going to be, they're not going to be like pages or anything.
Right. Nobody's invented a flexible battery or circuit board yet. So, well, actually, they do have flexible circuit boards, but they are not mass prototype production. So we are still waiting for the true smartphone of the future, but this is an advancement that will probably lead in a year or two to thinner phones, more durable and resistant to broken glass. And that will leave more room for larger batteries.
Yeah, you got to think that, that is something that will be happening. You know, smartphones are just too fragile right now, and a lot of it is due just to the glass of the screen. And, you know, I can't tell you how many people I see walking around with broken screens because they're on a contract and they don't want to get a new phone or something like that. So I guess this is kind of a research arm that hopefully will eventually solve that problem, right?
It will eventually solve that problem. Basically, what's happened is LG and Samsung have figured out how to eliminate one piece of glass from the phone.
Right.
So that's always good.
So remember when we tried this before? They weren't really flexible like this, but the what phone was that? It was one of the Nexus devices had a curved screen on it.
Oh, yeah, sure. It was the Galaxy Nexus.
Yeah. And that I've never really heard of a curved screen since then.
Right. So I think the difference with the Galaxy Nexus was that it was curved, but in no way flexible.
Right. Yeah.
Now they are building flexible displays, but those displays still have to be put into rigid phones.
Right. Makes sense. All right. So I wanted to issue the end user public service announcement. Adobe has leaked a database of its users. They've leaked some of their users' email addresses, an encrypted version of their password, and they've also leaked an encrypted version of credit cards, amongst a few other details. Those are the major ones. So this is 2.9 million people had their credentials lost, including myself. I went to adobe.com, logged in, and they prompted me for a password reset. So if you do have an account with Adobe, you should probably go over there and just reset your password, because the passwords were encrypted, but it's just a good idea to go over there and change it in the first place. So I see Canadian Geek there in the chat room is asking me, leaked or hacked? And apparently it was hacked. Somebody was able to compromise their servers and take the information, about 40 gigabytes worth of information in this case.
Yeah, that is a real shame. Hopefully they will be updating their security.
Their security, not all the information is out there, but from what I've seen, their security practice was actually okay, you know, in the sense that assuming your database is going to leak in the first place, you have hashed your passwords in a way that provides some security. So, again, I don't really have the full details to go off of, but even if they did it right, you can just nip that in the bud and just change your password and be done with it and not worry about it.
Sure, absolutely. They did the right thing here, and they're continuing to do the right thing. And I'm not worried about it too much because I am absolutely certain that I've never given a credit card or a password to Adobe.
Yeah, I definitely have, because I bought Photoshop at some point. So they definitely had my account, and my account was in the leak since they issued the password reset to selected users. And I went in there, and I was indeed in there.
Yeah, that's too bad. 2.9 million people is probably a pretty significant chunk of their paid customers.
Yeah. Okay, well, enough of the PSA. We've got a Green Tech Story of the Week coming up. What you got for us, Mr. Marr?
I do. Now, this one is a little complicated and esoteric, but bear with me for one second. Okay, so we all know that it's a good thing to add renewable energy production to the energy grid, right?
Yeah, to augment the existing grid with renewable sources, sure.
Right. So renewable energy has a few problems in terms of power fluctuation. For example, if you build a big field of solar panels and a cloud goes over the field, then you lose production from that field. And then the cloud comes, you know, passes, and then the production comes back. Or,
yeah, I also happen to know on modern solar cells, not only does a cloud or a bird dropping stop the existing solar cell from functioning, not only is that the case, it also becomes a load for the rest of the system. So when you block a solar cell, the area that is blocked, it's like a double whammy. Not only is it not producing power, it is taking load away.
Right. Well, the problem there is that solar cells are necessarily linked by voltage. So you have a voltage drop across the whole system when a cloud is over part of the system. So that it's absolutely a problem. It can be mitigated, but on large-scale solar facilities, that becomes really expensive. You have to add a lot of transformers and inverters. Anyway, so the problem is we have these renewable energy sources that are not capable of producing consistent, specific amounts of energy that traditional energy sources would be able to. Gas, coal, nuclear, and even hydroelectric are able to control specifically, if not necessarily quickly, how much energy they're producing. Now, the modern U.S. grid is not very modern at all. In fact, we are straining the capabilities of the grid that we have in place just to be able to maintain a high and precise amount of power that's needed across the entire U.S. at any one time. So what's been happening as certain nuclear or coal plants have been replaced by solar plants or wind farms, the fossil fuel plants like natural gas and other coal plants have been turned on and off at different points throughout the day or the year in order to meet the excess capacity demands. So that's creating a problem for these older power plant operators who are saying the wear and tear on their generators are outpacing the amount of energy that can be created by clean sources who are unreliable by nature.
Yeah, you really need a place. You need a place to buffer the energy coming from the renewable sources, right?
Yeah, that's exactly right. So the buffer is coming from mostly coal and natural gas power plants that have to turn on and off throughout the day in order to meet the energy needs. So they're saying that this is costing them money, turning on and off these turbines, and it's costing more money than we're saving. So a new study has just come out examining the costs and savings associated with each of these effects, and we save way more money than we spend by having renewable energy. So even if it costs more money to upkeep those coal and natural gas plants by turning them on and off, we would still come out ahead with renewable energy. But we save a lot more money by having those renewable sources on the grid than we would even lose under the worst case scenario of having a grid that was mostly renewable energy and fossil fuel sources that were turning off constantly to meet the rest of the demand. So if you had a grid that was 80% solar and wind, you would have a lot more fluctuation from those sources than we do now, where we have less than 10%. But even if we had that much renewable energy that wasn't consistent, we would still save more money even if we had to replace the 20% that would have to make up the difference.
Now, I'd have to imagine, Rennie there in the chat says it takes days to fire up a coal-fired generator, he's saying. And I'd have to imagine they're not actually turning it off and turning it on again. They're kind of scaling it back while the renewable source is producing the most and then scaling it up when the renewable source is not. So, you know, and I don't know what the time span for that is, and I don't even know if that's the case because it doesn't say it in the article, but I'd have to imagine it's not literally flipping it off and turning it on again from scratch, but some kind of scaling operation.
There's definitely a scaling operation, and the amount of time that it takes to turn each type of power plant on and off is all factored into modern grid management. So, for example, a hydroelectric dam can be turned on and off probably quicker than any other type of plant. And then after that, and I'm just guessing based on my amateur knowledge here, but this is just an example. So after that might come a gas generator. And yeah, a coal plant or a nuclear plant will take a lot longer to turn on and off. But they, in using all of those in series, they're able to create the most responsive and power efficient grid. And that's what they've already been doing for the last 10 years.
Yeah, cool. Cool stuff.
So the point is, renewable energy is worth the added demand on those other systems.
Right, yeah. For a long time to come, we're going to have hybrid systems. And the more we can make them work together, the more efficiency we can probably get out of these things.
That's absolutely right.
All right, well, on from green story of the week. Green tech story of the week, and on to our tip of the week. You've got us covered this week. What's going on here?
I do. Now, this is an iOS 7 only tip. So if you are an iOS 7 user like me, and you have been upset by all the bugs that have come with it, here is a cool little trick that you can use Siri to get to application settings. Even more than in iOS 6, the settings for all your individual applications have been put into the settings app on your iPhone or your iPad. Now, it can sometimes take a while if you just wanted to change a setting within the app, and now you have to navigate out, go to settings, find the app in there, and then make the change and then go back to the app. But you can use a shortcut by using Siri to take you right to the settings of the app inside your settings app. So all you have to do is say launch settings from within the app, and it'll take you straight to the app settings for the app that you want to adjust. So if I'm using Chrome on my iPhone and I want to adjust the Chrome settings, which are in a different app, all I do is from within Chrome, I open up Siri and I say launch settings, and I go right to the Chrome settings.
Yeah, that's pretty neat. Siri is kind of maturing over time. She's able to do some things that were just not there. And presumably, she'll be able to do more and more over time. And
Siri is either a man or a woman now in terms of the gendered voice that you hear.
Right. Siri is now neutral.
Right.
So it's good to see Siri mature a little bit and start to be able to do some things that just was not an option before. So that's definitely a good thing for iOS 7 users. And
yeah,
that said, I have Windows Phone 8, so by definition, I am one better.
Okay, Chris, if you say so. Now, it is great that Siri is making leaps and bounds here, but I have found that most of Siri's main functionality comes when you don't have your hands free, when you want to offload something and get Siri to do something for you. And you can do a lot more now in iOS 7 than you could in iOS 6. But this is one of the first Siri tips that I've found that actually saves you time, even if you're already using the phone with both hands. So it's a real time saver instead of an effort saver.
Cool, and you've also got an app pick of the week for us. What's this?
I did. Now, this is Windows only. Not Windows Phone, not Android, not iOS, not Mac. Just Windows. And this is a service called Connectify, who has launched a free version of their software, Connectify Dispatch. Now, I'll try to explain what it does pretty basically. If you have multiple internet connections, like you have access to a wired Ethernet connection or Wi-Fi and a 3G modem, Connectify allows you to combine those connections and get all of the speed and availability and flexibility of all of the internet connections that you have access to. So if you were in a hotel room and you had free Wi-Fi plus Ethernet connection, you could connect to both and then use both at the same time. And this software, this Connectify Dispatch, manages all of them for you, in addition to providing metrics about which one is better, which one's faster, and all of that.
Yeah, that's amazing. I know a lot of podcasters out there that go out into, staying in hotels and stuff like that, would love to be able to merge a couple sources of internet to provide a more reliable link. I wonder if it would work for that purpose.
Right. So this free version works for 24 hours. I think it's 24 hours total. That's all you get. And then after that, you can pay for a lifetime subscription or a yearly subscriptions.
Yeah, that's not too bad. It's $40 for lifetime for regular and $55 for pro. That's not too bad.
Yeah, it's pretty reasonable. And this was a Kickstarter project, and that has given them a great database of beta testers.
Cool. Well, speaking of beta testers, Boeing has also been a beta tester recently. And what do we got here? We got a pilotless F-16. What is going on here? This is madness.
Yeah, I had no idea that Boeing was working on something like this, but they have successfully completed a test flight of a driverless F-16. Now, I'm not sure why they needed to do this, but it does look really cool.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. They were for target practice, even.
So we made pilotless F-16s, and we let them fly up to Mach 1.5, and then we started firing missiles at them.
Yes.
This does not end well.
Yeah, all Skynet has to do is take control of those F-16s and turn them around, and we got trouble. And they successfully made it do a barrel roll with no pilot.
Well, doing a barrel roll is easy. It's just left on the joystick and B.
They successfully completed the Konami code in an F-16.
That would make me dizzy.
Yes, that would certainly make you dizzy, and you might stall and die.
All right. So, yeah, an awesome and terrifying futuristic kicker. My favorite.
Yeah, this is how Skynet starts.
No, it's how Skynet takes over.
Yeah, that's right. It's already started. It started 2 years ago in Wisconsin, and this is just its manifestation of weaponizing itself. Also, I completely made that up, so I don't know why Wisconsin, but there it is.
Yeah, I was wondering. I was like, what happened in Wisconsin 2 years ago? But I guess we won't know until Skynet decides to tell us.
That's right. You will never know. Definitely not. Okay, well, that will do it for this week. Taylor, if somebody wanted to contact you, should they send a pilotless F-16 with a letter enclosed in it to you, or should
please,
they get you on Twitter or something?
Please don't. Twitter would be better.
All right, so your Twitter handle?
Is at TaylorPhone.
Cool. So, yeah, you can follow me at Chris Hale Barnes if you like. Give us a tweet. Let us know what you think of the show. Yeah, that'll do it for this week.
No drone strikes, please.
So thank you, everyone, for listening to the show. And, of course, you can find more information, including the show notes, over there at thedigitalmediazone.com under the end user. That's THENDUSR. The DMZ has a handful of other podcasts you can have a listen to. Entertainment 2.0, Scene in HD, and the Movie Podcast. And the latest edition, Home On, all about home automation. You can also send us some feedback. Our email is theenduser@thedigitalmediazone.com, or you can get us together on Twitter. We are at @theenduser. Of course, you can join us in the chat room as we record the show live every Monday night, usually around 8:30 p.m. Eastern Time. I am your host and producer, Chris Barnes.
And I'm Futurist Prime, Taylor Moore.
Thanks for listening, folks. We will see you next week. Bye-bye.